This is a CBC podcast. Every Friday, Grant Lawrence turns your MP3 player into your source for new Canadian rock, pop, hip-hop, singer-songwriters, alt-country, and electronica. Go to cbcradio3.com and click on podcasts to find the CBC Radio 3 podcast with Grant Lawrence.
Hello and welcome to the Vinyl Cafe podcast. This week on the show, a brand new concert from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And just a heads up, make sure you listen right through to the end of the show, because this week there's a special bonus track just for the podcast. Hope you enjoy it.
From the Centennial Concert Hall in Winnipeg, Manitoba, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Every city has a verb of its own. St. John's huddles, Montreal argues, Toronto parties, Calgary sprawls, Vancouver crowds, while Winnipeg endures. It was not supposed to be so. Winnipeg was poised on the edge of greatness at the turn of the 20th century. At the turn of the 20th century, everything looked swell here at the confluence of the Red and Assiniboine Rivers, here at the almost geographic heart of North America, here at the bullseye. At the turn of the century, Winnipeg, with its thriving grain market and its sprawling train yards, was ready to ride the rails into the future. Destined, it was said, to become the Chicago of the North. It looked like Chicago, and still can from the right corner of the Exchange District. But along came the Panama Canal to spoil the view. Close to 30,000 people died constructing the canal, the long-sought shortcut to get stuff from one side of America to the other. 30,000. And with them, Winnipeg's dreams. Just like that, the center shifted. And Winnipeg, as others, no less than ex-Winnipegger Neil Young, have suggested, Winnipeg, which was supposed to be in the middle of everything, woke up and found itself in the middle of nowhere. First time I came here, I arrived the only way anyone should arrive in Winnipeg. I came by train. I was a 19-year-old student on my way west, going west, we used to say. It's what we did in the summer in those days. We got summer jobs or we went west. As long as you're ready to sit up all night rather than stretch out in a berth, one way Montreal-Calgary cost $35, about $350 in today's dollars. Winnipeg's where the train crews change, so when we rolled into the old CNR station, which was designed, incidentally, by the same architects who designed New York City's Grand Central Station. When we arrived at the station, we were allowed off the train. And even though it was the middle of the night, I went for a wander and managed to find a place to buy a burger. I like to think I got a nip at the Salisbury House. But it might have been a fat boy at VJ's. These days, I like to visit in the early summer when the trees are in blossom. If I have time, I'll wander around the Forks, a wander which inevitably ends at the Tall Grass Prairie Bakery, where I've stopped for a cinnamon bun more often than I care to admit. From there, with time on my hands, the Exchange District is my next stop. These days, I like to visit the galleries. The plug-in gallery is only a block over from the messy grandeur of Toad Hall, that great toy store that I've never left empty-handed. And it, just a stone's throw from the Mondragon Café, where I've whiled away hours with friends. I don't know all of this city, but I know parts of it. Some of the alleys, some of the architecture, some of the grit, and some of the grandeur. When you mention Winnipeg to people who've never been here, they're likely to roll their eyes and say something disparaging about mosquitoes or the winter. And I know, it's a dry cold. Those who've passed through might mention the beauty of the rivers or the golden boy on top of the provincial legislature, their memory of the Jets or their feelings about Portage and Maine, that most famous of intersections, now shackled in concrete barriers like some sort of political prisoner. They would mention these things, and probably something about the mosquitoes in the winter. But I would like to put forward these are not the things that make Winnipeg what it is. There is a spirit about this city and the people who live and come from here that I'd like to suggest is closer to the heart of it. There's an intellectual and political commitment to the collective, to the greater good that runs deep here. Winnipeg's motto is unum cum virtute multorum, Latin for one with the strength of many. This is a city where people fight for things. Maybe because they have to. It's where in 1914 Nellie McClung and her fellow reformers staged their famous mock parliament at the Walker Theater. Roles were reversed. Men had to beg for the right to vote. McClung's piece of theater was so successful that 2 years later, Manitoba's women were the first to get the vote in Canada. Winnipeg's the crucible of the Canadian labor movement. Workers in Winnipeg led the struggle for collective bargaining, better working conditions, and higher wages. The Winnipeg General Strike of 1919 had a profound effect on Canada and, no doubt, contributed to the political education of Tommy Douglas, who was living here at the time. It's a spirit that is still alive today. You can read it in the biology of this city. It's written in the trees. The American elm is the most gorgeous parasol-shaped tree. Planted along boulevards, an elm will grow tall and meet the trees on the other side of the road to form a dappled and dancing canopy. Any Winnipegger will tell you that walking under the shade of an elm canopy can make you feel as if you're walking through a cathedral. Dutch elm disease has devastated most of the elms of this world, but not here. Like the city, the elms of Winnipeg endure. Alone of the great cities of Europe and America, Winnipeg still boasts an elm forest, arguably the greatest urban elm forest in the world. And that's not an accident of biology, but a result of this sense of commitment that I'm trying to get at. I want to tell you the story of the Wolseley Elm. Wolseley Avenue meanders along like many of Winnipeg's streets as if it still believes itself to be the riverside path that it probably once was. Back in the 1950s, when Wolseley Avenue was a favorite shortcut if you wanted to avoid the traffic of Portage Avenue, there was, near the corner of Basswood Place, a solitary elm growing unbelievably right in the middle of Wolseley, standing in the middle of the street like a forgotten sentry box. The tree was circled at the trunk by a low brick curb and the tiniest fringe of grass. So tiny you could barely stand on it. So tiny it was designated by Ripley's as the smallest park in the world. You can read all about this on the web. Story goes that the elm was planted in the 1800s by a farm girl. And there it remained until city officials, fretting that someone might hit the tree and kill themselves, decided to cut it down. Neighborhood residents disagreed. In 1957, when the city finally sent a crew to deal with the Wolseley Elm, they were met by a group of neighborhood women who circled the tree arm in arm and told the city workers if they were going to chop it down, they'd have to chop through them first. A crowd of over 200 people gathered. The mayor arrived, and the tree was saved. A Pyrrhic victory. Within a year, the Wolseley Elm had been hacked at and set on fire by vandals, and it had to be brought down anyway. 50 years have gone by, but Winnipeggers are still talking about that tree. Prodded by longtime Winnipeg newspaper columnist Val Warrior, the citizens of Manitoba, alone in the world, took action to save their elms. Manitoba enacted legislation to make it an obligation under the law to cut down and dispose of diseased trees before the disease could spread. The Wolseley elm was lost, but Winnipeg's elms have survived. Life isn't always easy here in Winnipeg. It is hotter in the summer and colder in the winter, and every 50 years there's a monumental flood. Sometimes, says Guy Madden in his mysteriously beautiful film, My Winnipeg, it's so cold your breath freezes in front of your face and falls to your feet with a tinkle. The winters may keep people away, but as Madden says, Winnipeggers know the enchantments that can be squeezed out of a snowflake. So, yes, it's easy to look at Winnipeg from a distance and say it didn't become what it was supposed to be. More difficult to look deeper and to remember that farmers have for years left fields fallow as they seek to regenerate the soil, that there are cycles of birth and renewal. And in that light, to ponder where in that cycle Winnipeg may be and where it might be in the years ahead of us. Winnipeg, I've heard it said, is the hardest city in the country to get someone to move to and the hardest to get someone to leave. There's a scale of things here that some might dismiss as small, while others might see it as simply human. When you think about Canada, it's hard to think about a musical group who writes about their hometown with more feeling than today's guests. They're going to begin today with their anthem to Winnipeg. Well, actually, it's more of an anti-anthem. It's a song about the love-hate relationship many people have with their hometown, the deep affection that is constantly tripped up by their city and its politics. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the Vinyl Cafe the Weaker Thans. John Sampson, lead singer from the Weaker Thans, is going to start us off.
Late afternoon, another day is nearly done. A darker gray is breaking through a lighter one. A thousand sharpened elbows in the underground. That hollow, hurried sound of feet on polished floor. And in the dollar store, the clerk is closing up and counting loonies, trying not to say, I hate Winnipeg. The driver checks the mirror 7 minutes late. The crowded rider's restlessness enunciates. The guess who suck, the Jets were lousy anyway. the same route every day, and in the turning lane, someone stalled again. He's talking to himself, and hears the price of gas repeat his phrase, I hate Winnipeg. Up above us all, leaning into sky, our golden business boy, watch the north end die, and sing I love this town, then let his arcing wrecking ball proclaim, I hate Winnipeg.
It was John Sampson with One Great City, and that song takes its name from the Welcome to Winnipeg sign just outside of the city, which is Winnipeg, Manitoba, where we happen to be today, and that song's off the Weakerthans album Reconstruction Site. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true, and they have to be short. And after that, they don't have to be anything at all. We promise to read everything you send us, and we promise to read our favorites on the radio. Today's story comes to us from Ryan Brynjolfsson of Winnipeg, Manitoba. Dear Stuart, writes Ryan, last night we gathered together as many neighbors as we could fit into our local community center, set up tables for a potluck, and said goodbye to a community institution in Winnipeg's North End. Pollock Hardware has been in the neighborhood for as long as any of us can remember. The original owner bequeathed it to his stock boy. The current owners tried hard to find a buyer, but the time has come for them to retire to their cottage, so the doors are now closed. We've all appreciated the variety of things we could find at Pollock Hardware over the years. We live in an older neighborhood with older houses that require ongoing repair. Something always needs plumbing, patching, glazing, hanging, grouting, plastering, unlocking, or fastening. In our neighborhood, renovation is thought of as a leisure activity. We work our way through kitchens, bathrooms, windows, hallways, living areas, decks, fences, and then we start all over again. Not to mention the time we spend fixing the small appliances and bicycles that we buy from each other at garage sales. Pollock Hardware always seemed to have exactly what we needed. It's a mystery to me how all of that inventory fit into that store, and how the staff knew what we were talking about when we asked vaguely for the thing that fits inside the tap. And not only that, but knew exactly where to find it inside that store, even though no one had ordered that part since 1953. If they didn't have what we wanted, they'd improvise something out of baling wire and charge us 14 cents. Once, I was told, no, we don't carry that, but I got one at home I'm not using. I'll bring it in tomorrow. There were also, of course, the gadgets. Pollock's had a wonderful stock. A stock of practical and simple machines that don't blink and beep, machines that don't require electricity or counter space. Friendly, low-maintenance machines like egg beaters, nutmeg grinders, and my personal favorite, the apple peeler corer. Tools that sit quietly and obediently in bottom drawers until they're needed. All of these things made Pollock Hardware feel like a small-town general store or maybe even a community center. It was common to stay and chat for a while, try to postpone the renovation work waiting at home. So last night was difficult. It was a sad but special night. A number of people took turns thanking Wayne and Lois for their work. I'm still getting used to the boarded-up windows and the padlock on the door. I don't know where I'm going to find the washers for the antique plumbing in my house. I'm going to miss the cider and cookies at Christmas. So I'm buying a share in the co-op that a group of people have started to try to keep the store open. More than 50 people showed up at the first meeting, and we're hoping that the credit union will give us a mortgage and that we won't have to say goodbye to another wonderful Winnipeg institution. That story came to us from Ryan Brynjolfsson of Winnipeg, Manitoba, who I understand is here at the concert hall today, so maybe you could bring up the lights and Ryan can stand up and she can take a bow. Where are you, Ryan? These are the weaker thans.
Sparkled with broken glass, I'm back with scars to show. Back with the streets I know. Will never take me anywhere but here. This drink in my hand, the strangers whose faces I know. We meet here for our dress rehearsal to say, I wanted it this way. Parts of lonely. birthday card I threw away.
Those were the Weaker Thans, and that was Left and Leaving, and that song is from the Weaker Thans album of the same name, Left and Leaving. So the co-op to save Pollock Hardware had at the time of this recording a board of directors and over 90 members. Each member had bought one share in the co-op for $25, and I am one of the 90. Co-op has been negotiating with the owners to purchase the building and its contents and reopen the store, and the present owners are anxious for that to happen. I believe that we will all sleep better wherever it is we sleep, knowing that Pollock Hardware is still going, knowing that even if we don't live here, that if we ever pass through Winnipeg and happen to need a nutmeg grater or an apple corer, we'll know exactly where to go. For now, you can go to the Vinyl Cafe webpage at vinylcafe.com and find out where to send your $25. It's kind of like saving the elms. It's a small opportunity for everyone to live Winnipeg's motto, one of the more poetic urban mottos in the country, one with the strength of many. So the first time the kid stole a record, Dave missed the whole thing. In his defense, he was distracted. There was this other guy hanging around the store at the time, full of questions about suppliers and vintage records, the turntable by the easy chair, this, that, everything. Meanwhile, the kid was doing his thing in the blues section, though it's never actually been called the blues section in Dave's store. Back when Dave had names for each section in his story, he had a sign hanging over the blues records that read, "She never loved you anyway." The sign was still there in the days that I'm talking about. I'm not sure it's still there today. Anyway, the kid had his back to the counter. He was wearing tight jeans and a bulky army surplus coat. The coat was the tip-off. And Dave completely missed it. "Haven't seen these for years," said the guy with all the questions. He was pointing at the goldfish bowl of plastic centers for 45 RPM records. "Where'd you get them anyway?" Now, normally that's the kind of question Dave would enjoy. Actually, he'd say, "I got them from Sarnia." And then he'd tell a whole sorry story about how the company that made them went out of business and how he had bought a wooden crate the size of a casket full of the things. It's how he spends the better part of most days, talking about things like plastic record centers with his regular customers. But this guy wasn't a regular customer. And anyway, there was something about him that was annoying. It was around then that the kid left the store. He nodded at Dave as he slouched past the counter. Dave nodded back absent-mindedly. It was only hours later, long after the kid was gone and the annoying guy had left, that the penny dropped. Dave was tallying up the day's receipts when he stopped and stared across the store. That kid in the army coat, that kid had been stealing records. The way he walked by the counter, he might as well have been waving the record over his head. It had happened right under Dave's nose. It was Mr. Question Guy's fault. Mr. Question Guy had distracted him. Now, theft has never been a big problem in Dave's little store, and it certainly wasn't back then. The chains lose 4, maybe 5% to what they coyly call shrinkage. Dave hardly loses anything. His store, after all, is pretty small. Right from the beginning, he proudly claimed it to be the world's smallest record store. He emptied the cash register into the night deposit bag, $127. 84 in cash, 35 in IOUs, and $8 in Canadian Tire money, which Dave accepted at par from the day he opened. If it wasn't for the kid, not a bad day. He wasn't going to dwell on it. He wasn't surprised, however, when the kid showed up a week later. Dave spotted him the minute he walked through the front door. If he'd wanted to shut him down, he could have. He didn't, however, want to shut him down. He wanted to figure him out. There was something about the kid that fascinated Dave. He was an awkward-looking boy, maybe 16, all arms and legs. He was flipping through the records filed under D. Okay, was he a dork or a dude? The thought made Dave smile. And it was that thought that made Dave decide what he was going to do next. He wasn't going to stop the kid. He was going to play what if instead. What if what? Okay. If he took the new Dylan, he'd let him go. If he took Duran Duran, he'd nail him. Dylan or Duran Duran? Dude or dork? Dave walked to the front of the store. He stood on a chair and fiddled with the speakers by the front door. He was giving the kid a chance to make his move. When he came back to the counter, the kid had moved to the back of the store. This was a little like chess. My move, thought Dave. Dave went over to the D's. The Dylan was gone. The kid had won, fair and square. He'd have to get him the next time, which happened to be that weekend. The kid walked in on Saturday evening, just before closing. As soon as he saw him, Dave thought, okay, enough is enough. This has got to stop. He waited until they were alone. And when they were alone, Dave walked over to the kid and put his arm on his shoulder. Hey, said Dave, friendly enough. The kid stiffened and turned. Dave was smiling. He had his other hand out, ready to shake hands. And oh yeah, the kid had a record squished under his arm. No doubt about that. Dave's hand was still extended. My name's Dave, he said. I've seen you around a couple times. The kid took Dave's hand awkwardly. What else could he do? Dave shook it energetically. The kid gasped. Dave was shaking the record loose. The kid leaned against the counter. Nice move, thought Dave. "My name's Nick," said the kid. The kid looked terrified. He was squirming up and down against the counter like an elephant scratching on a tree. He was trying to shift everything back into place. Dave couldn't help himself. He liked the kid. He decided to give him one last chance. Dave said, "Do you like Dylan, Nick?" The kid nodded. He had no idea what was going on, but he knew it was bad. Dave smiled. Dave said, "What about Duran Duran?" Dave was playing what if again. The kid said, "Duran Duran? I hate Duran Duran." Dave said, "Good answer." And then, without thinking about what he was doing, on an impulse he never understood but grew to be proud of, because it worked out so well, Dave offered the kid a job. "A job?" said the kid. The kid's head was spinning. "Yeah," said Dave, "I need some help after school. You look like an honest guy." Things were definitely not going the way the kid had expected them to go. The kid said, "Working? Like what?" "Helping out," said Dave. "Stocking, cleaning, looking out for shoplifters, that kind of thing." The kid swallowed. Kid said, "I don't think so." Dave said, "Good," without missing a beat. "Why don't you start tomorrow?" "Minimum wage, except for tomorrow, of course. You've already been paid for your first 4 hours. Dave clapped him on the shoulder and gave him a last friendly shake. The album the kid had pressed against his body fell to the ground. Dave pretended not to see it. "See you tomorrow," he said. And he turned and walked back to the cache. The kid picked up the record and put it back in the crate where he got it. On the way past the counter, he stopped and said, "My name isn't Nick. My name is Scott." Dave said, "I'm still Dave." "See you tomorrow." And so went the days at Dave's little record store. This was, as I've said, a number of years ago when his daughter Stephanie was still in high school, before he carried any CDs at all. Scott, no surprise, fit right in. He mastered Ringo, the game of flipping 45 record centers across the store to moving turntable. They used a homemade catapult assembled from a mousetrap. In his third week, he scored the first ever Epstein by landing a center directly on the spindle, a feat which David decided was impossible and caused him to close the store. They all went out to lunch to celebrate, including the store's only other employee in those years, Brian, who invented the game and was called in for the meal and was paid for the entire afternoon. Things were good. As good as they'd been for a long time. Everyone got a small raise at Christmas. So when the lawyer's letter arrived, it came, as they say, like a bolt out of the blue. A cease and desist letter from a guy who owned a place called the Vinyl Cafetorium. Store that was, according to this letter anyway, legally the world's smallest record store, had, according to the letter, trademarked that phrase. The letter informed Dave that he had to remove any and all signs that mentioned the size of his store, or a complaint would be filed in the provincial court to seek an injunction to stop him from exploiting the phrase. "What?" said Kenny Wong when Dave burst into his cafe waving the letter. "That's what it says," said Dave. "Take down the signs," said Kenny. "Or," read Dave, "they will seek compensation for damages both actual and statutory. Whatever that means." "That," said Kenny, "means war." They went to check it out that night in Kenny's 1984 Lada. Dave riding shotgun, Scott in the back seat. It was almost 10. They figured it would be long closed. It was supposed to be a drive-by, a reconnaissance. The store was lit up like a riverboat. The world's smallest record store, open till midnight. "But it's huge," said Dave. "It's not huge," said Kenny. "Well, it's way bigger than my place," said Dave. "Well, how hard's that?" said Kenny. The walls were exposed brick. There were posters on the pillars. "The place is cool," said Scott. "Those posters aren't messed up like yours." "That's because mine are real," said Dave. There was a counter along one wall with an espresso maker. Behind the espresso machine, there was a guy in a white apron who looked strangely familiar. "I know that guy," said Dave. "That guy used to come in the store and ask questions. It's that question guy." "I can't believe it. That guy was spying on me." Dave had his hand on the door of the car. He was about to jump out. Kenny reached over and put his hand across Dave's chest. Kenny said, "Let's go." Scott said, "Before we go, can I go in and get an espresso?" Dave couldn't believe it. Back in the early 80s, when everyone else had been talking about expansion and growth, Dave had happily stayed small. Then he had resisted the urge to update and renovate and redecorate. He had intentionally set his bar low. Really low. And now someone was telling him he wasn't even big enough to be small. Dave went into the cafetorium the next day. It was a Tuesday morning, the quietest morning of the week. He wasn't doing anything except fretting, and he couldn't stand it any longer. He dropped the blind on the front door and reached under it and set the hands on the little raccoon to say he'd be back in an hour. He went upstairs and poked around the storage room looking for a disguise. He found the perfect thing, a suit with a dress shirt and tie. Just as he headed out, he grabbed his lunch. If anyone asked, he was going for lunch. That's what he was doing. He had no idea what he was going to do when he got there. Didn't even have a plan. He just had to see the place again. He was acting on impulse. As he walked along, he was telling himself he wouldn't go in. He would just walk by. And then his neighbor, Mary Turlington, breezed by him without a second look. He felt invisible. When he got there, Mr. Question Guy was nowhere to be seen. There was a young girl behind the counter. She had the store's sound system cranked loud. She was playing the best of Duran Duran. Before Dave knew it, he was at the back of the store, furtively unwrapping his lunch, a sardine sandwich. When it was open, he took a bite and slipped the rest of it onto a shelf above a heater. He went back the next day. He couldn't stop himself. He had to see what had happened. "There's an odd smell," he said to the girl. "It's been here all day," she said. "It's driving me nuts." Dave felt a pang of guilt. It wasn't her fault. He ordered a chocolate milk and gave her a generous tip. He headed to the back of the store to fetch the offensive sandwich. He spotted the poster on a pillar halfway there. "Don't be fooled by imitations," read the poster. "This is the real deal, the official world's smallest record store." Dave sighed. He headed back to the shelf at the back of the store. Instead of removing the sardine sandwich, he placed the glass of milk beside it and left. On Saturday, he called the store from a payphone. He used a fake name. He ordered a copy of Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart. That would keep them busy. He had no intention of ever picking it up. Dave had become the coyote. Question Guy was the roadrunner. Pretty soon, Dave had an Acme catalog of plots rebounding inside his poor little head. He'd pay an exterminator to park his van outside the store with a big sign in the window that read, "Emergency Call." He'd hire what's-his-name, the guy with a ukulele, to stand outside and play the same song over and over and over. Pop Goes the Weasel. He spent hours in front of his computer Googling things like revenge, world's best, deliveries, manure, fresh. It's all he talked about. It was Scott who brought him to his senses. It was a Friday night. It was a delicate moment. For a 16-year-old, Scott handled the moment with surprising sensitivity. He put his hand across Dave's computer keyboard and said, "Have you noticed that you might have lost your mind?" He's stealing my ideas, said Dave, pushing him away, standing up and starting to pace. "He wants to steal my store," said Dave. "Yup," said Scott. "So what do you expect me to do?" said Dave. "What would be best," said Scott, 16 years old and not yet shaving, "is nothing." "Nothing," said Dave. "Exactly," said Scott. "Nothing is exactly what you should do." Then he said, "I went over there last week. I went through the whole place, and you know what? You're right. The coffee's terrible. And you know what else? He doesn't have blood on the tracks or blonde on blonde. He doesn't even have Highway 61 revisited. He'll be out of business in a year. All you have to do is wait him out. I know this guy stole your idea, but believe me, all you have to do is wait." "You don't know what it feels like," said Dave. "Maybe," said Scott, "but I know a little about theft." "And I know robbing an idea is nothing compared to having one. The guy is nothing. This place is the real deal." And that was that. A couple of months passed before Dave visited the cafetorium again. He almost didn't recognize the place. The sign was still up, but it had been shifted to the right. What had been the left side of the store was now an entirely new business, electronics. And the Vinyl Cafetorium, now half its original size, was little more than a coffee shop with a few racks of CDs crammed against the wall across from the espresso machine. Dave smiled. It may be small, but it wasn't much of a record store. And Scott was right. It is easy to steal an idea. It's better to have one. And it's better still if you believe in the ideas you have. As Dave headed home, he was thinking about how much he was looking forward to going to work that day. It would be, he was sure, a quiet day. Not many customers. Just a few sales. Business, no doubt about it, would be slow. As usual, he'd spend more time at the turntable than at the cash, and that wouldn't bother him one bit. In fact, he couldn't think of anything in the world he'd enjoy more. It was the next afternoon, sitting alone in his empty store, that he scribbled down the little phrase that has been his motto ever since. He wrote it on the back of an envelope that was lying on his desk. You can see it yourself if you ever drop in. It's pinned on the bulletin board by the cash in a black felt pen with a big exclamation mark. "We may not be big, but we're small." Thank you. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank our special musical guest, The Weaker Than. Thanks also this week to Bill Herault, Brad Scruton, Joe Dudich, and Greg Boboski for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. And Julie Penner of Winnipeg is the music producer. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and we're going to let the Weaker Than sing us out. So long for now.
For the song of knowing you're gone, glancing up at where you lived when you lived here, I see you suddenly alive and nearly smiling. Stop and hold my breath and watch the way you used to be. The full moon makes our faces shine like over iron polyester. Night windows. We could walk to where these streets get pulled together, a blinking line. Gravel shoulder square towards an end, where the radio resounds from Doppling traffic, where the power line steel S's from the hourly news depluralize our cat.
John Sampson, Weaker Than.
That was this week's show from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And now, a special bonus track just for the podcast. This is an outtake from our show in Winnipeg. This is The Weaker Thans with Sun in an Empty Room.
And last week's papers, rumors and elections, crosswords on unending war. The black in our fingers smear their prints on every door pulled shut. Now that the last month's rent is scheming with the damage deposit, take this moment to decide. Tried,
sun in an empty room.
Or felt around for far too much.
Sun in an empty room.
For things that accidentally touched.
Sun in an empty room.
The hands that we nearly hold with pennies for the GST. The shoulders we lean our shoulders into on the subway. Mutter an apology. The shins that we kick beneath the table, that reflexive cry. The faces we meet, one awkward beat, too long and terrified. Know the things we need to say.
Sun in an empty room.
Been said already anyway.
Sun in an empty room.
My parallelograms of light.
That was Sun in an Empty Room, and that's off the new Weaker Thans album called Reunion Tour, which is a great album.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.